Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Casey Grant, and I am the host of the Fly Girl Show. And as I always say, but I always mean it every time I say it, we have somebody really interesting for you to meet. It is another one of the people that participated in the Fly With Me, the PBS documentary that aired February the 20th, and I am still so excited about it. They did such a fantastic job, the producers that produced this were just off the chart with giving us the history of the flight attendants and the trials and the tribulations that we went through, and highlighted such wonderful people that I was just pleased to meet. You're going to have an opportunity to meet one of the people that was highlighted in the film that was produced, as I said, by Sarah Colt and Helen Dowoski, and it is just a wonderful documentary that people need to see, and please pass the word to everyone. So with that, I'm going to give you just a little introduction to my guest today, and her name is Patricia Ireland, and she flew for Pan Am for 7 years, between 68 and 75, until she graduated from law school, which a lot of people is too funny about. And people were flight attendants and going to school at the same time. And so that was one of those common things, but law school was really a challenge. And then she became full-time national officer of NOW in D.C., and she's going to give you more information about all of that. And that was in 1987. And she served as president from 1991 to 2021. And then at that point, she went back to Miami, practiced law, and just retired April 15th, 2023. So she has been an active person, and we had a blast in D.C. together. And so I am honored and happy to bring her on the show for you to get to meet this amazing woman and learn about how she helped the fight for the flight attendants and for women's rights. So this is an outstanding person, and at this time it is my pleasure to introduce you to Patricia Ireland. Good morning.
Hey, Casey, how are you?
I am just fabulous. I am fabulous.
You are.
Peachy keen, as I like to say. I'm having a great day. Peachy keen here in Chicago.
Well,
the sun is...
I didn't mean to interrupt how beautiful the weather is up there. You know, I was born in Chicago, so I'm amazed that this time of year you've got the sun and all of that. It's going to go up to something like 70. But I also wanted to say, we did have a wonderful time in D.C. I thoroughly enjoyed spending time with you, but it wasn't nearly enough time. So I'm glad to join your show this morning.
I know it. Isn't that the truth? We just clicked immediately. And what we are talking about to my audience, we were in D.C. for the press release of the documentary that was produced by PBS, and it is called Fly With Me. And it aired on February the 20th. But for those that missed it, please go on YouTube and pull it up. And please tell everyone, it's really getting a great response. It's really filled with such wonderful history, things that I didn't even know. And actually, one of the things is meeting Patricia. So at this point, please give my audience a little rundown, introduce yourself, and tell them about what you've been involved with in all these years. Where are you from?
I was born in Oak Park, although my parents were living in Berwyn at the time. And all my family is from up there on both sides. But I decided to start moving south because I discovered you didn't have to spend winters at 20 below.
I know.
My family had moved around Lake Michigan to a place called Valparaiso, Indiana, when I was fairly young. And so I grew up in kind of an agricultural area. It was at that time the 50s, and as some of your listeners will remember, that's when women's choices were pretty much limited. I had always heard from my mother I should be a teacher so that I would have something to fall back on in case my husband died or left me, and it would have been better that he died so that I would have something to fall back on. That was the way to frame it. And I thought that would be great. But then when I got to be, 18, 20 years old, I just started feeling that might not be for me, or at least I wanted something more exciting in the meantime. And so because my grandfather had been in the airline industry, I had kind of thought I might like to be what was known then as a stewardess. I was at that time waiting tables in a restaurant, and I thought, well, if I'm going to serve food and drinks, I'm going to do it at 35,000 feet and end up in Rio when I'm finished.
Isn't that the truth?
It was a very exciting way to find out about the world. And for a young woman who grew up in the corner of Indiana, it really opened my eyes. My eyes had been fairly narrow focused. So that was exciting. And it should have opened my eyes that I went for the interviews, because I can tell you, TWA, for instance, the interviewer asked me to, I was wearing kind of a flared skirt, and he said, pull your skirt back so I can see what your body looks like. Mm-hmm. And they put me on a scale because you had weight restrictions, height restrictions. You couldn't wear glasses. You had to be a sparkling personality. It was a great job for me,
Let me interrupt you and comment on that pulling the skirt back, because you just made me remember during my interview, he had me turn around and pull my dress tighter so he could look at my butt.
Right. excuse me, does that help me serve food, or would that help me in getting people to go out the emergency exit without carrying their baggage if there was an emergency?
Isn't that the truth? You just made me remember that. I had forgotten all about that degrading thing that we had to do. Mm-hmm. And I was, when I did it, I was like, well, wonder. But then he said to me, your hips aren't as big as you said they were on the application. I mean, I didn't know. Who knew about measuring? I just put down what I thought. That was something. Oh, but anyway, I'm so sorry. But go ahead and I finish talking about rude awakening.
It was a rude awakening. The first time I got to Miami, where, as you know, I've been since 1968 with that interruption to go up to D.C. for 17 years. The training for Pan Am, which is where I got the job, was in Miami, and we had a period of, I guess, 6 weeks. The job was at its core for the safety of the passengers. And so out of that 6 weeks, we spent 1 week on learning how to evacuate an airplane, how to deploy the slides, what to do if somebody had a heart attack. I was so excited because I wanted to deliver a baby at 30,000 feet, and no pregnant woman would ever cooperate. So that 1 week was really what the core of the job was. But we also spent a week on makeup and hair, and what color lipstick we had to wear and what kind of underwear. They're even concerning themselves with our underwear. So that was a pretty interesting introduction to the job, and still I thought it was a small price to pay for getting to travel around the world, for getting to meet such interesting people, including people like you, Casey, my coworkers. I found that stewardesses, now called flight attendants, were among the most interesting, funny people. They were flexible. You had to be with your schedule. They enjoyed life. They were funny. I thought they were my saviors when things got too obnoxious on the airplane. We would gather in the galley and make up funny stories. I can remember once a passenger had rung the call button on takeoff. We were still at that slant when you're taking off. And I thought, oh, my goodness, I'm going to get to perform some life-saving activity here, because no one would ring their call button for service when we're still, you know, ascending at that. So I crawled my way up to the front of the cabin, and she said, I'll take a Coke with no ice. Well, I just turned around and went back to my jump seat, and so the rest of the flight, my colleagues and I started imagining, if you had killed her, where would we hide the body? And imagining some poor, maintenance guy opening the compartment where the life raft was, and finding a body wrapped up in there.
You're bringing back all these memories. Yes, because when they ring that call button, because once again, as I always like to say to everyone, your flight attendant is a safety feature, one of the most important safety mm-hmm. features on that plane. You go through the training to save their lives and heaven forbid, evacuate an aircraft. But I've had to do the same thing. You sit there on the jump seat and you go, now you know that's not an emergency, but you have to climb that as it is climbing, which is that gravity mm-hmm. pull on your body to try to get to the person, and then they look at you, the nerve of you to ask for a Coke.
Right, right.
Oh,
at least
I'm
you could have said, I need
you
to
is
take
what
some
we're
pills,
do.
Give me some water, right?
I'm telling you, for Coca-Cola, I'm telling you, no. But, yeah, you didn't even have to worry about where to hide the body. You should have just thrown them out the window, which is even harder to do, audience, as we do know.
I never had to evacuate an airplane, but we used to say I could evacuate a 747 upside down underwater in the dark in 90 seconds. And okay. That was the mantra. And at the same time, yes, it was a service job in between. And I observed that once. I did fly into Washington, D.C. on an airplane where the landing gear would not come down. Mm-hmm. And so we had to do a belly landing. Well, mm-hmm. I had been upgraded to first class, and I'm a connoisseur of good airplane service. And those flight attendants were so attentive, so funny, so friendly, and did such a good service. The minute they found out there was an emergency, everything changed. Their body language changed. Their tone of voice changed. There was no question you were going to do what they said because it was going to save your life. And
exactly.
I was so impressed that they could change on a dime. And that's where the training came in. Every 6 months we had to go to training.
Absolutely. And that is the difference. And we do. We just change roles immediately. And we don't even realize the transformation. All we know is we're there. We are a safety feature. And we have been so well trained through FAA, through your company, to do that. Because that is exactly why these people who act are so unruly now in airplanes. You just don't understand that your life is in the hands of this little girl that you are harassing. In
uh-huh.
a minute. Oh, I know. And then the people, the 6'2" guy that comes on, and he's such a big, burly guy. As soon as that emergency comes about, he changes because they will pay attention
mm-hmm.
to you then. Yes.
Yeah. Yes, they do.
Mm.
And you know what, Casey? It doesn't matter if you have on bright red lipstick in accordance with the company's rule or a girdle. I could still evacuate a plane. Now, the planes are much safer. I mean, when I was flying, there was, the worst idea was a fire on the plane. And now they have much better fire-resistant materials. But we were, you didn't burn up. You died from smoke inhalation if you went down in that sense. So I think it's a lot. I don't want to scare people from flying because I fly all the time. I worry about getting to Miami International Airport with these crazy people driving on the roads. But once I'm on the airplane, I feel pretty safe.
Isn't that the truth? I know you just took me down memory lane because I had forgotten those two scenarios that we just talked about, climbing, trying to get mm-hmm. to a person that rings the call button, and there was no emergency. And,
right.
All the other things. But tell us about some of the different changes or the sexism that you experienced way back then, because Pan Am to us, you were the, when you were a Pan Am flight attendant, that was the epitome of a stewardess, not flight attendant, a stewardess.
Mm-hmm.
They were crisp. The uniforms fit immaculately, the hair, the makeup, and you were going to all these exotic places. I was on Southern Airline, Delta, and all we did was Paducah. That was one of the first places, one of the codes that we had to learn is puke. And it was like, that's Paducah. I know. That's how I remember, because I flunked that first test, but I didn't flunk Paducah. And, oh, my goodness. And so all those different things. So we just went, our whole thing was about eating Southern cooked food. You were going all over the world and meeting exotic people and customs and everything. So tell us about, though, the things that you witnessed, I mean, the racism, because it was there,
mm-hmm.
and the sexism,
yes.
It was there. So tell us some of those stories and what made you go into fighting for women's rights and protecting or fighting for the stewardess's rights.
Yeah, it was an incredible transformation, because I had been raised to be, and I was to the nth degree, an accommodating, sweet young woman who did what she was told or asked. And it was quite an eye-opener for a number of reasons. One is that if we thought the United States had restrictions on women, I mean, we could be teachers, secretaries, what else, nurses. But if we thought that was restricting, it was nothing compared to what was going on in some other parts of the world. I did fly to Tehran. It was when the Shah of Iran was still in power. And we could not go out into the marketplace or to shop for anything without a male accompanying us. And we had to wear long skirts and sleeves. So learning about the rest of the world and the incredible restrictions, which I would now say were very oppressive to women, was an eye-opener for me. And, of course, the racism was blatant. Their language was terrible. In fact, it was a huge fight to get the airlines to even fly, to hire African-American flight attendants. The prejudice at that time in the countrywide against lesbians and gays was, you know, multiplied by 10 in the airline industry. So it was a very, I mean, I hadn't even thought about such things, really, if you can imagine, you know, that I got to be an adult and never thought about racism, never thought about anti-Semitism. I don't know what I learned in history class, but it wasn't about Black history or the Holocaust.
and you know what? And that's the truth. And that's what I always like to say to everyone. My background was the military. My father was in the service.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't know those things either. I didn't know to say, he's
right.
This, he's that, and she's – we didn't identify people like that. We were like, you know, Mary, she's a cute little girl, or, you know, we didn't do that. And when you get
right.
into the airline, we were all so innocent, and we enjoyed the experience, and we all developed friendships within that family that we
yes.
didn't understand everybody else wasn't – so receptive to greet or to embrace another person just because we liked them.
Yeah, it was, I think it was an eye-opening experience that ultimately led me to be a strong women's rights supporter and go on to work for the National Organization for Women. Part of the reason that I wanted to go with NOW as opposed to some of the other organizations was that NOW was what I would call as a full feminist organization. That is, we supported women's rights and women's equality, and we fought against racism and homophobia and classism, because there was a lot of discrimination based on what your education and your economic situation was. So it was a real I'm sure the airline didn't intend it to make me such a radical, but it did. I found it was the passengers, but it was also the pilots. It was the pursers. I ultimately became a purser, and many people don't know what that is, but on international flights, we did all the, all the liquor paperwork, but we also did all the immigration and customs paperwork. We actually, on Pan Am, assigned the flight attendants where they were going to work, first class, aft, cabin, galley, you know, whatever. So I eventually checked out as a purser, but I did it. It was a little more money, but because we got separate rooms and mm-hmm. the stewardesses were all bunking in with other people, I got mm-hmm. so tickled with the documentary Fly With Me, because one of the women who fought hard to get single rooms for stewardesses said that one of the other flight attendants sent her a note saying, "Every time I walk around my single room naked, I think of you."
Right. I read that. Yeah. But, you know, I want to ask you a question, though, because it seemed to me, though, I used to see women of color with Pan Am. Uh-huh. But I guess I just never paid any attention. There weren't any African Americans. So because it was an international airline, I really thought that Pan Am had broken that barrier a lot earlier than other airlines. But now you're saying that it took a little while to hire a black for Pan Am.
Yeah, I don't know. I would have to go back and do the research.
Exactly.
But, they were hiring young women from all over the world. You had to have at least two languages. And so primarily I flew with Latinas and European women. Sometimes there were some women from the Middle East, but again, that's a place where women were not supposed to do such things. There were some women from Africa. Most of the women from Africa had been educated in Britain, for instance, and so they would get hired in London. But it was like the rest of the world. You know, there's hierarchies that we seem to all be inculcated as children. Everybody's got to be better than somebody else, you know, mm-hmm. or... Nowadays, I guess I would say that political people do that when they will say, you're hurting, you don't have a good job, you can't make enough money to support your family. Well, don't look at me who sets all the policy. Look over there at that African-American person. Look over there at that immigrant. Must be their fault that you're not doing well.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
I think there's a purpose to continuing all of that, is all those isms. But I will tell you, Casey, one of the things that struck me watching the documentary was how far we have come. And I was particularly interested because I have been fairly discouraged. There has been a really vicious backlash to some of the progress that we've made for...
Yeah.
People of color, for women, for lesbians and gays, and you know, LGBTQ+. And now you have to have such a big chest to wear the T-shirt nowadays. but we have been pushed backwards in some measure, but we will never go back to the way it was. I don't think we may take three steps forward and one or two steps back, but we never go all the way back. And that's why I thought the my experience, but also this documentary, showed what individuals can do, how they can make a difference, but even better, how they can make a difference when they join together. And so that, to me, was very encouraging.
What was one of the things, if you can remember, what was one of the most eye-opening thing that you saw when you started working? And I also have to tell the audience, since we have them so intrigued with this, part three of my comments on the Fly With Me documentary is going to be the very first flight attendant for Pan Am, the first African-American, and her name is Undra Mays. So we will be getting her side of the story of what you and I just talked about Pan Am resisting. And so she's going to give us her personal story. So stay tuned, audience, and make sure you come back in another hour after this a conclusion of this interview to get the interview for Undra Mays. But what was one of the first eye-opening things that you saw, the things that were just, you know, unjust to how they treated the stewardesses back then that gave you, because what did you do? What was one of the things that you fought so hard for Pan Am to change? Do you remember?
Oh, certainly do. I mean, there were other moments that we would describe as, you know, where the click went off in my head.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what really pushed me over the edge. At that time, finally, we could be married and still fly as stewardesses. But the companies, of course, were interested in making money. And one of the ways they saved money was that they kept a constant turnover of flight attendants so that you never got older and you never had to use health insurance for the kinds of things that go wrong with my body in my 70s. But I was married. We used to joke and say, you know, the machinists for Eastern had T-shirts that said, marry me and fly for free. And that's why James and I actually got married. The flight privileges were great. We could fly around the world for $100, but we needed health insurance. And Pan Am had great health insurance for its employees. But when my husband needed dental surgery and I went into the benefits office and they looked at me like I was nuts and said, oh, gosh, we don't cover the families of our female employees. Now, if you were a man, we would cover your family, but we don't cover women's families. And
no.
I was...
No, excuse
yes,
me, but
ma'am.
What year was
this
that?
This is probably 1971. It was already wholly illegal not to compensate men and women the same, but nobody had challenged it. And that was, so I went to the local chapter of the National Organization for Women now. And I talked to the woman who said to me, and I liked that she didn't do for me. She educated me so I could do for myself. She empowered me by saying, well, you know, President Johnson has just signed the executive order mandating that federal contractors to treat men and women equally or put their federal contracts at risk. Pan Am flew R&R from Vietnam for the military air charters, and we also did machinist work, mechanical work at the Cape Kennedy, now known as Cape Canaveral again. So I didn't even have to file a complaint. I just went back to the office, and somebody from the Labor Department had called them because they said to me, oh, there's just been a terrible misunderstanding. If you are the head of household, which I was because my husband was a student at the time, if you're the head of household, then of course we'll cover your husband and family. And with that, the family, you know, the issue was solved. I thought at first that I had just solved an individual problem that my husband and I had an economic issue for him to be able to get medical care. But I went into the flight attendant lounge at the airport one day waiting for a flight, and another married stewardess came up to me and threw her arms around my neck and said, wow, we won. And that we changed so much for me. I realized that it's the genesis of the slogan, the personal is political. I thought I had an individual problem. It turned out it was a systemic problem with Pan Am's corporate policies. And I felt so powerful. I mean, I had made this international company change its policies all over the world, and it gave me a decidedly unrealistic view of how easy it was to make change. But it really did make a difference for me, obviously, and for all the other married flight attendants. You didn't have to be a head of household. And then, of course, speaking of the military, which was your family background, a few years later, a then attorney for the ACLU Women's Rights Project, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who went on to the Supreme Court as a justice, argued in front of the Supreme Court that military women should be able to provide the same benefits for their families as military men did. Military women at that time could not get family housing for their families. And so it was one of those things that I don't think a lot of people had thought of. I mean, we thought about equal pay, we thought about sexual harassment, although when you and I were flying, we didn't have the word sexual harassment.
We did.
It was a legal remedy. Yeah, we experienced it, but I didn't know what that, you know, sexual harassment, once somebody said it, I understood it. But I just thought, wow, that's just part of the price I paid for such an exciting, wonderful job. And by the way, in the restaurant and bar business, I experienced sexual harassment there, so it didn't seem to me so strange that on the airplane somebody would pat my behind or, as you said in the video, reach across as if they're trying to get something and get a feel of your breasts.
Yes.
You know, never occurred to me that that was so wrong.
Yes.
It's like, that's just
I know.
The way it is.
And we just
that's the way
it.
Men are.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank heavens for the light bulbs going off and for people realizing how much trouble they can get into when they were not respecting our position and disrespecting women. And this is exactly what we've all lived with. And you made a statement earlier about how we may take four steps forward and we may lose two, but we're never, ever going to go back to losing all of our rights. And I think that is exactly what's happening now. They're trying to take away a lot of women's rights, and definitely the thing that's going to irk us the most and make sure that we do not allow is to take away the right of our own bodies.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's just
unheard
of.
Well, I was interested in the Fly With Me documentary that the historian, his name was Still, and I can't remember his last name, but in any case, he identified the airline's restrictions on our height, our weight, whether we could see without glasses, as control of women's bodies. And, of course, as the president of the National Organization for Women, I was very happy that we had gained access to birth control and abortion, and now we see that that's been taken away as a right by the Supreme Court. But we've also seen that voters have really rejected that restriction on women, and especially when it has gone as far as Alabama saying that fertilized eggs that are used for in vitro fertilization for couples who desperately want a child and go through the expense and hassle of IVF, those fertilized eggs are humans. They're babies, like an acorn is a tree.
I know. Well, I said they're going to get to the point now if you they're going to start marking the days that you ovulate, and they're going to make sure that, okay, on this day you would have produced so many eggs, so therefore, I mean, how far is this going to go?
And when I was president now, people would say to me, well, don't you resent the fact that you had to fight so hard for these rights and now these young women just take it for granted? And I would always say, no, I want them to take it for granted. I want them to understand that these are their basic human rights, because then when it's taken away, as the court did take away Roe v. Wade, they're going to fight for it. And I am seeing that. I'm seeing that with a lot. I mean, we've got a Gen Z woman running for office. We've got a Gen Z man in Congress now from Florida, Maxwell Frost. And, you know, they got involved because they saw the backlash. And it heartens me. It encourages me. Because at this age, I can remember a folk singer named Phil Oakes, and one of his songs was, "I Ain't a Marchin' Anymore." I might need a, you know, a motorized wheelchair to march these days.
Exactly. We may, but it's out there. So the point of it is we can still do it. So let me ask you another, some more questions about your days of flying and the things. So that was the first thing that you fought for, that you, the insurance thing, which was a big thing because, you know, we never even thought about retirement. So therefore, when you're talking about insurance, it was all a new world to all of us. We were 20s. Mm-hmm. We were in our 20s, and our parents had taken care of it. What do we know about insurance?
And in our 20s, of course, we were going to live forever, and we were never going to have any ailments, you know, never have any problem with shortness of breath or, you know, any of the other, you know,
can't move.
Bad
no,
knees.
We never did. So therefore, you know, the airlines, they didn't really know, but to keep us ignorant and keep us young and happy and running around and think that we're just, you know, the cat's meow because we're so cute, never to sit around. We were all dumb blondes. We didn't think about these things, that there is life after, you know, 10 years you should be thinking of this. You want to have a family, and if your kid is sick, how do you go? So, but the point of everything is back then, the story is, you were looking forward, as your mother said, you know, you thought you were just going to be a wife and everything, but have something to fall back on. Well, we were all groomed to grab a husband off of in first class and marry him and never have to worry about anything, because that's not what women, you didn't have a career. That was not what you considered. So when you fought the first battle, which was monumental, now that we all understand how important insurance is, what was your next, so the light bulb had been turned on for you. So did you witness other things that at that point started to really irritate you and you realized this is not fair, that is not right?
Yeah. And of course, once the light bulb goes on, you can never, ever turn it off again. You start seeing all kinds of things around you. But I really believe that the stewardesses were probably the least powerful people in the company. And so we had to report to, and we had to keep the pursers happy, the passengers happy, the pilots happy. And I can remember, because Miami was, we always say Miami faces south. We don't face the rest of the United States, but rather the Caribbean, the Central and South America. And there were lots of problems at that point. Cuba had been, had fallen to Castro shortly before I started flying. And there were a huge number of Cuban refugees in the Miami area. So there was a lot of political violence. I don't mean to attach that to Cubans, but to say that they were fighting, literally fighting to get their country back. They had lost their homes, their businesses, everything left behind to come here and start from scratch. And there were violent gangs that started hijacking airplanes. And here in Miami, there were bombs, not just bomb threats, but bombs that went off at one point about once a month toward people who even suggested that we talk about talking to Castro. So here I am on an airplane, and we have a bomb threat. We're at the gate, and we evacuate, you know, 130 disgruntled passengers. And I'm standing in the front cabin having just completed the evacuation of the passengers back into the terminal, and the captain comes out of the cockpit and says, "While we're waiting, Patricia, would you cook me a steak and make it medium rare?" And so, you know, the soon-to-be president of the National Organization for Women found herself in the galley of an airplane that might explode at any minute, cooking the captain a steak medium rare. And that's when one of the light bulbs went off, that I'm on an airplane that might explode at any minute, and I have been so conditioned to be compliant with authority that I was doing it. So I marched off that airplane, and I said to the captain, "Cook it yourself." And I was like, but then I started noticing, my gosh, we had to wear these little pillbox hats, and the men didn't, you know, and we had to wear girdles, and of course the men didn't, and all these things that were, you know, just minor irritants, but all of a sudden it all started adding up. I couldn't enjoy the popular culture. So many movies, so many songs were so sexist that I could hardly, you know, and so it pushed me over the edge big time, and it took me a while to kind of, you know, get back to a more effective frame of mind where I could talk rationally with people who disagreed
mm-hmm.
with me.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, because you see it, and you really, when people talked, you were paying attention to what they were saying, and then you also
right.
realized how they were not informed as the reality of what
mm-hmm.
they were saying.
Mm-hmm.
So then I would
right.
feel at that point you became an educator, because you
exactly.
had the light bulb had gone off for you, so you became the crusader to enlighten everyone else's narrow vision as
mm-hmm.
to what was really happening. And that's what leaders do.
Yeah, and it wasn't easy because you have to keep raising issues that make people uncomfortable. Change, even good change, is uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
We like the known. We like what we grew up with. And so it was always difficult because a lot of us who once we saw the light got very angry. You know,
yes.
things that I had never seen as discrimination. Like I had in undergraduate school, I had a biology teacher who I had been married right out of, high school. The marriage didn't last a year. But when I went to my biology professor and told him I was taking my family name back, that I had gotten divorced, he made a big pass at me and basically said if I expected to pass his course, I had to comply. And I thought, you know, what did I do that made him think that I wanted to have sex with him? Not what a jerk he was,
exactly.
how he was abusing his position. But once my eyes were opened, I looked back at these things because I had never thought I'd faced any discrimination. But once I saw it, I was like, oh, my God, that guy was really a jerk.
Well, you know, I know. But you know, I'm going to interrupt you because we're getting close
sure.
to the show ending. But we have the switchboard has been all lit up, and there are people that want to talk to you. So I'm going to take a call and just try to get a
okay.
comment here. And then we're going to go back because we have, about 15 more minutes of this wonderful show. So let me see if this caller wants to make a comment or just continue to listen to our wonderful show. So hello, caller. This is Casey. I am the host of the Fly Girl Show. Did you want to ask a question or make a comment today?
Well, good afternoon, Casey. This is Dr. Michael Fontaine. I'd like to certainly make a few comments. And first of all, well, say happy springtime to you here in Chicago, although the calendar does not suggest it. The temperatures actually are going to be close to 70 today. Also, I wanted to say hello to Pat. It is a real pleasure to make your acquaintance there, Pat. And although
hey.
We've never met, I wanted to congratulate you and Casey on a great PBS documentary, and you as particularly as an agent of change in the air travel industry. The documentary Fly With Me was absolutely outstanding. I also wanted to acknowledge you on a very impressive article, both you and Casey, in the Washington Post. I was fortunate enough a couple of weeks ago to actually be a part of the pre-screen for the documentary. The trailer was about 40 minutes long, which was very impressive, and then I subsequently was able to watch the documentary in its entirety. Also, I participated in a Q&A with the panel there in D.C., and there were some very interesting questions raised and some very good responses. What I'd like to certainly acknowledge is the fact that this documentary was a perfect way to chronicle the trials and tribulations of women stewardesses in the industry and their sacrifices and their ultimate trials and tribulations and trials and triumphs over a male-dominated industry. So, again, congratulations to you as being a pioneer in this industry and bringing a lot of this information to light that was never really acknowledged or even talked about back during the early times of air travel. So thank you, and I look very much forward to meeting you in person one day.
Well, I think you raised some very interesting points, Professor, because even in the feminist movement, even in the National Organization for Women, I don't think we had any full appreciation of what the flight attendants had done and what, we haven't mentioned the word ageism in the program yet, but there were flight attendants whose airlines required them to quit at age 32 or 35, depending on the airline. And so the whole notion that you could not be attractive or appealing except if you were young. Now, that was the cover notion. The reality was they didn't want stewardesses who stayed around for a long time, who joined the union, who became active and tried to change policy. But how they got to that, the flight attendants, Dusty Rhodes was wonderful, wonderful woman who passed away just at the end of last year. She got eight flight attendants, and four of them were under 32 and four of them were over 32. And she had a news conference and challenged the reporters to identify who was overaged in the airline's view. And, of course, they couldn't. And ultimately, of course, we had to challenge not just who was 32 and who wasn't, you know, who was over 32, but the very notion that the flight attendant job, which is, after all, for your safety, that the flight attendants had to be really sexually appealing, although we were supposed to be chaste, which is why they put us in girdles. But we were supposed to be, you know, well, maybe, you know, at least I could flirt with her. So it was, I thought, the only feminist who I know who fully appreciated it was Gloria Steinem, because Gloria spent her life on the road, and she knew the stewardesses, and she knew their trials and tribulations, and she was very outspoken and was very supportive and physically present when the Stewardesses for Equal Rights was founded. So it's been a wonderful history, and I, who had been a stewardess and became a strong feminist activist, had not fully appreciated the role that flight attendants played, first of all, in trying to solve problems for themselves, but in doing so, changing the image and changing what was acceptable. I have to just say one quick thing. One of the people who challenged the female-only flight attendant rule was a guy who challenged Pan Am and took him to court. He wanted to be hired, and Pan Am actually went into court and said with a straight face, well, you know, nervous flyers, people who are afraid to fly, are going to be much more comforted by the maternal aspect of a female flight attendant. Now, mind you, if you were actually maternal, if you had a kid, you were out the door. And, of course, they lost that case. There were so many aspects that highlighted on a micro level the problems that we have in society as a whole.
Well, I don't know if Dr. Fontaine wanted to make a closing statement to you, so we can continue. So, Dr. Fontaine, did you want to say anything else before we move on to the next topic?
Just one more thing. You know, certainly I think not only you all as agents of change in this documentary, it actually clearly defined the role of the stewardess and subsequently flight attendant as being that of safety. I've heard you speak before that the captain was the first point of safety, and then subsequently they were the stewardesses, and people actually, there was an exploitation going on that you all were basically looked at as waitresses in the sky. And certainly you did serve, you served people, however, you all had a much more important role than simply that. Your role was that of safety to calm passengers down when there was heavy turbulence. If, in fact, there may be some type of incident in the air, you're able to control that. So, basically, I think that this documentary helped to explain how significant your role was other than simply a pretty face in the sky.
Thank you, Dr. Fontaine.
That's my closing comment.
Thank you.
Dr. Fontaine has really put his finger on it. But before we lose time, I want to say, Casey, you have written a book. And I want to know a little bit about your book, because it's not something you and I have discussed in Washington. We were so focused on the documentary. Maybe your audience already knows, but give me just a little thumbnail of what your book is like.
Well, thank you for asking. And Dr. Fontaine's was so brilliant, and it just encapsulated everything that we said. You know, we have fought for so much, and I was so proud of you to meet you and to listen to what you have done. And I love I can see it, you know, the light bulb going off, and every time you talk to someone, it's kind of like, oh, let me turn your light bulb on because you really don't understand what's happening here. And so that was very, I was glad Dr. Fontaine was able to realize everything that you and I have been talking about and feels the passion that we lived through and had to fight for. But I flew for 35 years, as I think my audience, but new people may be listening. Yes, I flew 35 years. I say I was among the first for Delta Airlines, only because affirmative action made the airlines hire blacks at that point. And I say it was a sprinkle here and there of being hired, and so I'm happy to say. So what I've done is I've written 3 books on black aviation history, and the first book, Stars in the Sky. Yes, Stars in the Sky. And all my books are on Amazon, Kindle, and Barnes & Noble. And the first one, which is the blue cover, Stars in the Sky, and it tells about breaking the color barrier, all the trials and tribulations that I had gone through to get the job, which, you know, it was not easy. I mean, and it isn't easy to this day because there's like probably tens and thousands of applications every day for people wanting to get into the field of aviation and, in particular, flight attendant capacity. But that's what my book, the first book, tells all about that. And in my book, as you had said about the bombings, we had the hijacking. I have a murder mystery in there where one of the flight attendants living this wonderful, glamorous stewardess life was murdered. And we did not know, her family did not know what happened to her for almost 20 years. And it was because of DNA that her story was finally, she was one of the first for Delta. And it's an interesting story. And even moving forward and reflecting the climate of how terrible these passengers are these days, I was attacked on the airplane in the 80s. So that's all in, that's all in that blue book. And then I have a children's coloring book that highlights the pioneers, the black pioneers in aviation, their accomplishments, and just a little tidbit of history. The call button was invented or inspired by a black woman. And
really?
So who knows that story? And she was in the House of Representatives. Well, actually it started with a chair. She invented where you would push a button in the back of your chair, a little light would come on, and it would beckon for the waitresses or waiters to come to cut down on you screaming to get the attention. From there, she went into politics. That became a way to signal that you wanted to speak while they were having, yes. And then from that, it was inspired to be a call light, a call button. So who knows that?
Right.
Who knows that?
Now I do. Thank you.
And now you do. And when people read the book, I was just in all of my discovery, I was impressed with that. I never knew. We just knew the call button was annoying because it was ding, ding, ding. But anyway, so thank you for asking. In the last book, because we only have now about 6 minutes to go, the last book is Stars and Beyond, and that book is formatted for the school system. And I highlight from astronauts to NASA's program and the heart surgeon that monitored the heartbeat of the astronauts and all of these different fields in aviation that people just don't know about. And so I've given tribute to people who have made their contributions. So I'm working on the fourth book, which deals with DEI. And one of the people I'm highlighting is a armless pilot. She flies an airplane, her private plane, with her feet. And then I have another one that she flies with her hands because she's paralyzed. So diversity, equity, and inclusion is an important thing, and it should be highlighted in aviation also. So that
I'm just
going to
tell you.
Yes.
My goddaughter has children who are 4 and 9, and they're getting the coloring book. I'm going to order the blue book. Was it Stars?
Stars in the Sky.
Stars in the Sky. I want to read that. And then I'll work up to your third and fourth book because I want to be smarter, better informed. So
better
I'll benefit
informed.
From your research.
Better informed because you definitely – well, I am going to close the show, but I am just so excited. And I know my audience were tickled to listen to some of the stories. And as I said, they'll walk away, they'll look at a light bulb and never forget how we have put the light bulb back into their minds of realizing that there's a brighter side, a more knowledgeable side to a lot of things that you must be aware of. So I really appreciate this interview with you. You were fabulous in the documentary, and I think that people need to understand and go see it, view it. It's on YouTube, so anyone can see this documentary on YouTube. Just put in Fly With Me, and it's a fabulous production by Sarah Colt and co-producer also Helen Dworsky. And I just want to thank them so much for creating it. So thank you so much, Patricia, for being on my show today.
And I learned things, too, so I'm delighted to have been here. I can't wait to read your books. And I hope you enjoy this beautiful spring day. Say hello to Undra, who is, I gather, your next hour.
Yes, yes, yes. And now I'm going to close this wonderful show. So thank you so much, Pat, and I will talk
to
you
soon.
So long. So long.
Bye-bye.
And bye-bye. And for my audience, I hope that you learned a lot today. And I think that you did because we really talked about a lot of things from A to Z. Please, once again, I cannot say it more than a million times. The documentary Fly With Me is so worth seeing. It's on PBS. Check your local viewings because they've been repeating this several times now. I've heard people call and say they're playing it again. But if you happen to miss it, please go on YouTube, put in Fly With Me, and sit back, grab some popcorn, and you will really enjoy this show. So with that, I am going to close this part. This is part two of my follow-up comments from some of the people that were featured in that wonderful PBS documentary. So please stay tuned. And for part three, where I will be introducing Undra Mays, who is the first flight attendant for National Airline, African-American stewardess for National Airline in Pan Am. So at this point, stay tuned, and I will see you later. This is Casey Grant of the Fly Girl Show. Goodbye.